All right, so today is September 27th, 2011. This is the first interview with Tim Frandy. We're here inside a research room or study room in Memorial Library on UW-Madison's campus. And my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm the head of the oral history program at UW-Madison. So, Tim, thanks for agreeing to meet me today. The topic basically of this interview and the follow-up interview is going to be the protests that were held on the Capitol grounds and inside the Capitol in February and March of earlier this year. But since you are a graduate student, and we don't have a lot of oral histories with graduate students, I think I'm obliged to ask, we'll ask the first question, which is, why did you choose to attend graduate school?
Oh, I don't have the best answer for that. I did my undergrad in Stevens Point, and I was in English and math, and you know, I was always sort of just good at school. Some of my professors, you know, said, "Oh, you should consider graduate school," and so I did it. I always thought, I come from a family of educators too, so I always thought that teaching would be a good career path for me. Then I ended up at graduate school in Washington State for a couple of years, where I got an MA in English, and then I came back here. I developed a sort of interest in regional literature, in particular of like the Lake Superior region, and so I returned to Madison because I wanted to get back to Wisconsin, which is where my family lives, and I also wanted to learn the Finnish language because it was sort of emerged from my research interests in Washington. And so Madison's one of the few places that teaches Finnish.
Okay. I want to ask a couple of follow-up questions mm-hmm. on what you just said there. First off, you said you come from a family of educators. I'd like to, if you don't mind, if you'd talk a little bit about your mother and father, and also tied into that, where exactly you grew up.
Well, I grew up in a town called Arborvitae, which is just a few miles north of Minocqua. My dad's family, were very large extended families, my dad's family, most of them live in Manitowish Waters, which is about 25 miles north of Minocqua, right on Highway 51. And my mother's family is from Danbury, Wisconsin, which is in the northwest corner of the state, about an hour south of Superior, 2 hours north of Eau Claire. So all those places I sort of consider home, you know, in various senses. My father was a school teacher. He taught high school math. He's retired now. My mom's retired too. She taught for a couple years. She taught English in Chautauqua, but she didn't like teaching because she's kind of shy in front of people in large groups. It would make her nervous. So she ended up being a church secretary. I'm on my dad's side of the family. He taught. His two brothers taught. My grandmother, his mother, taught. On my mom's side of the family, several of my aunts and uncles teach, you know, various levels of school. But it's kind of just part of the, you know, part of the family, part of the annual life, having summers off and working hard during the semesters.
So it sounds like your DNA gave you no choice. You had to major in English and math in college.
Just drawn to certain things for whatever reason. It had really nothing to do with them, you know. I took classes. I haven't done math for years, but it was just easy for me. And it was a nice balance to all the reading. I started off as a music major, though. So, you know, but that didn't go so well.
Where did you go to school in Washington?
At Washington State University. It's on the east side.
Pullman,
yeah, you know it.
So what drew you there?
To Washington State?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reality, coming from Stevens Point, which is a small school, you know, you have fewer options when you're talking about grad schools. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm from a small town, you know, always did well in school, but, you know, I had no concept that, like, if you're going to do something like career academic, you know, a career in academia, then doing your undergraduate at a Research One institution is important. That didn't make it, I had no idea, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of limited my options. Like, I couldn't get into Minnesota, I couldn't get into Michigan for grad school. You know, and maybe it was my writing and stuff too, but I, you know, I think the degree from a smaller school was definitely not an asset. But that said, I think that the quality of education is phenomenal there, you know, working directly with professors and, what was your question? Why Washington? So
right.
My professors came out of Washington State mm-hmm. for their graduate work, so they had connections over there. And, you know, it's unfortunately lots of it, what goes on is who you know. So I went to Washington.
Well, as someone who grew up somewhat nearby in Idaho, I'm interested in your take on your 2 years mm-hmm. in Pullman. Both in terms of the sort of the academic, but then also the sort of the social aspects of living in Pullman as well.
Where are you from in Idaho?
I'm from southeast Idaho, so okay. I'm from a long ways down, yeah. But I had friends who went to University of Idaho, so mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Never was on campus, but I knew of mm-hmm. What we call Wazoo.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you wouldn't mind talking just a little bit about an overview about your time there.
Well, it was different, you know, it was it was a big stepping stone. When I was there, anyways, the English department was sort of a hostile working environment. There's a lot of competitiveness, and there were some very aggressive people who would, you know, and I don't mean to target them, but there were, you know, there were largely this like aggressive Marxist MA students. Mm. It was like a clique of them, and they would go around and tell everyone that their research wasn't good enough, or your research is racist, or, you know, and it was really stressful. And it was being such a small town, the culture of the department was very insular, because few people who attended school there were actually from Washington. People came from all over the country. And then they're thrust into this environment in this very small farming and university town. And the only people you saw during the academic year were your department. People didn't have lives outside the department. So it was very tight-knit, very insular. And I developed strong relationships from there, but it was a little bit of an intense experience. And then, you know, with the infighting too, it was a really uncomfortable place to be working. So it's
interesting. Not that I don't want to get too much of me on here, but I mean, I grew up in rural Idaho, mm-hmm. but I did my graduate degree at Utah State, which is just across the border in Logan, Utah, mm-hmm. In a small town, a very small Mormon town. Mm-hmm. And my 2 years in graduate school was very insular and very in a department that was very contentious, to say the least. Mm-hmm. And so you saying that sort of brings up some memories for me
yeah.
of what my 2 years in graduate school was like, too.
What was your degree in?
History.
Okay.
So I ended up hanging out a lot with history and then American studies and folklore mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. because we all came in from outside of, well, I didn't really, but the rest of them came in from, most of them came in from outside of Utah or outside of sort of this Mormon mm-hmm. Enclave. So. Mm-hmm. We really had no choice, we felt anyway, but to hang out with each other.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of congruency with the rest of the outside, either undergraduate or the community.
Yeah, yeah. Very very similar experiences, I think. Here it's been a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, quite different.
Well, let's talk about that. So you mentioned briefly why you chose UW-Madison. And you talked a little bit about your research interests, but I wonder if you would delve into that a little bit more and perhaps start with what your research interests were when you came here, and then if that has changed over time, why?
Well, I think my research interests when I came here was largely because I'd been working with regional literature from the Lake Superior region, in particular the Upper Peninsula, and I was interested largely in the Finnish-American community, which, you know, like I said, caused me to want to learn Finnish. And this was all done about was in Washington from 2001 to 2003. So then I came here in the summer of 2003. And so for my master's thesis, I had written on this. And, you know, I'd read, started reading some Finnish folklore then. And I started, you know, reading some of the scholarship of Tom Dubois, who's my advisor now. And so, you know, I got a little bit interested, but it was largely like Finnish Americana stuff, immigrant studies, ethnic studies. I've always, since my undergrad years, I've been interested in ecological criticism, which has been sort of the basis of a large chunk of my research, like literary eco-criticism. And so then I came here and I started with those sorts of interests. But then, you know, as I started studying with Tom more, then my research interest, I mean, Tom's a really wonderful scholar and very broad-based. He publishes on all sorts of folklore from all over the world. You know, he's worked with, you know, I guess the big changes are that he's, you know, sort of instilled in me are an interest in Sami culture. Now, more than that, right now, I work more with Sami people than Finns or Finnish Americans. So that was a big change. He's also interested in religious studies. So I was working with worldview issues before, so they kind of overlap. But he's done fieldwork with shamans, for example, and looks at shamanism during periods of colonial transition in Arctic Scandinavia, in Arctic Russia or Soviet Union. And so I've taken a large interest in that sort of aspect too. So, you know, I've written on shamans and such. Let's see, I suppose the other thing I've been looking at, labor issues too, I suppose is relevant to the interview. Jim Leary, you probably know Jim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's worked a lot with labor in the past. So it comes in part from him, and part probably more so just from the fact that I started getting involved with TAA shortly after I came here.
And I want to ask about that, but I do want to ask you to clarify or elaborate on a couple of things you mentioned.
Sure.
And the first is ecological criticism.
Yeah.
Would you explain, maybe give the Reader's Digest version of what ecological criticism is?
It's sort of a post-structuralist look at environmental themes in literature, in the literary sense. There's different ways to approach it, but, you know, I suppose in the sort of old-fashioned view, it's man versus nature, but, you know, the reality is that it's not an antagonistic relationship, and it looks at how, you know, green spaces, forests, waters, farms, land, the environment, you know, in its various forms are constructed. You know, is it a place that's passed through? Is it a place that generates economy? Is it a place? Is it a common space? Is it shared? And if so, what sort of social rules, formal and informal, regulate the use of these environmental spaces? There's a lot of nuance and complexity to it, but, you know.
Okay. The other thing is, you said you're now more interested in the Sami culture. Could you spell that and then explain what that is?
Yeah, Sami is S-A with a slash, M-I.
Okay.
Or the A is written with the accent line over
the
top.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And Sami people are they're also formerly called Lapps, L-A-P-P-S.
Okay.
But, become sort of a derogatory term now. They live in the northern parts of Scandinavia and in the Kola Peninsula of Russia, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Russia. They're indigenous people. They speak a Finno-Ugric language. It's related to Finnish. And they historically, they've been known for herding reindeer. They live in Guahti or Lavu, which are, they lived up until like the 1950s, 60s, They were living in basically tipis, which were lavu, or turf huts, which are the guahti. They lived a subsistence-based economy for until fairly recent times. And now there are, sort of mixed economic realities where they'll do a lot of fishing and hunting and have some reindeer, but then they'll have a day job too. I work with them on various issues. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that, I'm guessing, means going there to be with them. Is that true?
I go over there and I do my field work and I do interviews and take photos and, try to learn things that I can, that can learn, serves as the basis for lots of my research.
When did you, or do you recall, you've been here since summer of 03, your involvement in the TAA, how did that come about?
I wasn't too involved my first, I got here in 2003. I was technically a special student, and then the spring of 2004 was the strike semester, and I was only marginally aware of the TAA at this point. I wasn't terribly involved. I wasn't involved at all, really, with that strike. But it certainly heightened the awareness. I walked a little bit on the picket lines. I don't even know if I'd signed a membership card at that point. I think it was the fall 2005 when I became more serious about it. At some point, I had signed a membership card, and the staff organizer, Rob Henn, contacted me and called me, and we met at a cafe. It was Steep and Brew on State Street, and I was all ready to get involved anyway. So then I started sitting on the Stewards Council that for a few years, and then got more seriously involved, I think, in 2007-2008 academic year. There was the CAPE campaign, too. I think that was during the fall of 2006. That's when I really started getting involved.
Could you elaborate on the CAPE campaign?
The CAPE was the Coalition for Affordable Public Education. It is a coalition group that was spread throughout campus, like Louise Robbins from Profs at that time, she was involved with it a little bit. The whole idea was there was a restructuring in the way that grant money was going to be, channeled off to the university if you're hiring a project assistant. Under the old system, I think it was a flat fee of about $4,000. If you're hiring a project assistant, they take $4,000, you have to budget in your grant $4,000 to go and pay for the tuition remission of this graduate student. John Wiley was involved with, he set up a task force to say that this is the problem, we're losing money at the university, and the task force came to, was charged with finding various options as to how to go forward. And the option that they recommended against, but said that, but which Wiley liked, was to double the amount of that grant money that's used to fund the tuition remission. So instead of having to spend $4,000 of your grant money to pay for tuition remission, then everyone was spending about $8,000. And so and what ultimately resulted was a net loss of PA ships, and now PA ships are very hard to come by on campus, relatively hard. The CAPE was an organization that was, it was trying to oppose this change because it wasn't good for the research at the university. Professors didn't like it because they couldn't hire project assistants easily. Then that grant money started going to other universities. I don't know the numbers on it, but that was a theory anyway, that they're less competitive in writing grants. It's not good for the graduate students because there's less funding to go around. And we made the case that tuition remission isn't real money. You know, it's money that the university never collects anyway. So what does it matter if they're collecting $4,000 or $8,000 off a grant? You know, it's just skimming money off the top. But the university didn't like that argument very much because they're short on money. And there was some weird budgeting things because of the university is forced to budget in certain ways through the state statutes, that the university has to budget as if it has tuition money that's not actually there for graduate assistants. You know, just one of these crazy things. There's more details, but it's probably not terribly relevant to our conversation. Yeah. Anyway, that's sort of what CAPE was about. They're still around. There's all sorts of issues that I think they're working on. There was, graduate students can't get in-state tuition rates. We can live and work here for 10 years, but we're not qualified for in-state tuition rates if, so long as we're classified as students. So, you know, that's a big issue that should be fixed, but there's not a lot of incentive to fix it, obviously, because it means declined revenue for the university.
Mm-hmm. So in your situation, because you're born and raised here, are you considered a resident?
Yeah, I've always had residency.
Okay.
And there was something I found because I had to get residency in Washington, which was easy. But then I came back here, I was worried about it, and they said, if you graduated from a Wisconsin high school, then you have residency for Wisconsin in terms of tuition. So that's never been an issue for me.
But as we talked about earlier, with folks going to graduate school, they usually are coming in from a different state to go to graduate school, so it is an issue for those folks who...
Yeah. I don't know the numbers. I would guess that about two-thirds of the students are out of state who are graduate students.
I would guess that's a fair guess. I don't know it either. But
I think it's two-thirds or three-quarters. Or mm-hmm. And I mean, we're forced out of state for our graduate work. It's you know, career suicide if you go to the same school for all of your degrees. You know, it's mm-hmm. just not a good way to get a job.
Right.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about your involvement in the TAA. The next question is, and this is obviously getting us up to the events of earlier this year, were you involved in politics, or would you consider yourself to be involved in politics before February of 2011?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely.
Could you just maybe elaborate a little bit on your involvement in politics pre-2011?
Well, for me personally, the electoral side of things has always been my least favorite aspect, but, you know, following CAPE, you know, I got more and more involved with the TAA. I was the co-chair of the Stewards Council. Then in 2008, 2009, I was co-president of the TAA. The electoral stuff is important and interesting. It's never been my favorite side of union work. I prefer the organizing work that goes on.
Could you, you gave a really nice example of CAPE. Are there other things sort of after CAPE, and I'm sure there are, but are there things that stand out in your minds after the tuition remission issue and then February 2011 that you were interested in working on, either as part of the TAA or on your own?
Sure. Let's see. Well, some of the bigger things that went on during those couple of years, there was the big fight to get domestic partner benefits on campus. You know, it was this campaign that, like, the TAA was actually instrumental in launching in the 1990s, I think around 1990, were the first state union to be pushing for the fact that, you know, gay and lesbian people or unmarried people should be able to, you know, have family insurance plans or, you know, have, you know, hospital visitation rights and these sorts of things. And so we pushed for it hard. I think once we won it in the contract in 2000, and it was then the state assembly or senate, I'm not sure which one, we were denied our contract because it was controlled by Republicans who didn't want to give gays or lesbians these benefits. But in 2008, when we flipped the Assembly and Senate to Democratic control, we were able to get them in writing. And now, of course, they're under attack again. But so part of the work, the project in getting this done was we had a huge electoral program in 2008. You know, it was easy because of, you know, all the Obama energy. But we were able to do the same thing on a state level. And there were many close elections that year that were, for like state senate and assembly, that were decided by less, like 1,000 votes or less. And TAA people, you know, in conjunction with, you know, the AFT, Wisconsin, and, you know, the South Central Federation of Labor, which is the AFL-CIO regional center. There's a large campaign to get out the vote in, like, rural out, because Madison's safe, right? So we were taking carloads of people out to the outlying districts, you know, 2-3 times a week over the weekends, and doing labor walks, which have, you know, walk lists of people who are members of the AFL-CIO, and we knock on the door and, like, give them literature and remind them to vote and tell them that their union has endorsed these candidates. So there was that. There was a large campaign around the natatorium referendum too, which was TAA led. And that, of course, there was an ASM election, right? They did this for the Memorial Union renovations under John Wiley. Under Wiley, they had 3 votes because he really wanted to use SEGFI money to pay for part of Memorial Union renovations and a new union south. And they held a campus-wide election, and the vote failed. So there were so many votes cast. It was one of these online elections. There were so many votes cast that the system crashed. It was overwhelmingly no. And then he said, "Oh well, you know, this system didn't work. You know, we can't trust these ballots. So we have to do it again." So a couple months later, they had the same election. Can we use SEGFI money to pay for these new buildings? And votes came in. No. So then he thought, oh, we'll try it a third time. So, you know, an ASM at that time was really controlled by sort of two very chancellor-friendly people. The chancellors will take undergrads and bring them to, like, the chancellor's mansion or whatever it's called, and sort of wine and dine them, get on their good side, and then the students feel all self-important and are convinced that whatever the chancellor wants. I mean, they're used as tools. So the third time this ASM referendum came up, and they decided to only have it. They took out the electronic voting. They had to vote by ballot over the course of 2 or 3 days. There were only 2 locations, and at the same time, I mean, the voter turnout was less than 5, like maybe 3% of the student body, or 3 to 10%. It was really low voter turnout, and they had Memorial Union employees, like, out on the sidewalk saying "vote yes," which is actually kind of illegal, or illegal-ish, you know, on paid time, mm-hmm. and they purposefully didn't advertise this coming election very much. I mean, they were trying to get the result they wanted, and so it squeaked by, you know, and most of the students didn't know about it. And I think that jacked up SEG fees about $250 a semester. At that time, it was maybe 2007 or something, maybe 2006, the TA wasn't very well prepared for it or organized. This thing kind of slid by and nobody was ready for it, and it wasn't good. When I was co-president, we met with Biddy Martin, and we brought this. The idea when Wiley was leaving out to build a new natatorium was already kind of on the radar. And, you know, we'd heard about this, and, you know, we sort of had the attitude, never again. We are never letting anything like this get by again. Could we totally drop the ball? All these students are being charged more money, you know, for a building project. They could have funded in other ways. So when I was co-president with Mark Sipanich in fall of 2008, we went and met with Biddy Martin, and you know, we sort of mentioned that we have a lot of members who are very concerned about building projects, and that we had heard that the natatorium was going to be funded in this way. And she said, that's terrible. That's terrible. I haven't heard of this. I don't know anything about this. And then, of course, about a year later, she's out pushing for more increases in seg fees so they can build a new natatorium. You know, of course, she's acted outraged that that segregated fee money could be used for building projects at the time. But obviously, when did they put that election through? That was, I was actually in Finland when the election happened. It was spring of 2010, like February or March. I thought it was March of 2010. I was living in Finland at the time. So then they got this on the ASM ballot again to vote for fees in the natatorium. And the TA launched a large campaign, like vote no to, you know, increase seg fees campaign. And they held the election, and it failed miserably, the proposed amendment. So the building money was not there. It was like almost 2-1, I think. Over 60% voted against the increase in seg fees.
Since we're not sure who's going to listen to this in the future, could you elaborate a bit more specifically on seg fees, like what they are and
Segregated fees are fees that are charged to all UW students in addition to tuition dollars. In theory, they go to a number of important student causes, such as a free student bus pass or university health services and various student organization groups, all of whom deserve to be, you know, funded. The problem is that since tuition has been capped by the state, and this is the case in many states, tuition increases are capped by the Board of Regents, when universities can't raise revenue through tuition, and they're certainly getting less every year from the state of Wisconsin, then they've been raising segregated fees as a way to sort of have a backdoor tuition hike. And so fees now are being used more for, you know, there's a lot of unknowns, actually, but, you know, one small part is the building projects. And, you know, at other universities are used, they charge like $100 elevator fee. You know, I think that's at UIUC, University of Illinois, Champaign, Urbana. Or maybe it's in Chicago. I can't remember which one. But it's a national trend.
Thank you for that. So one more thing before we get into February 2011, and that's November of 2010. Mm-hmm. You found out, and you could speak either as you know, yourself as a student or as a member of the TAA, you found out that not only did a Republican win the gubernatorial election, but also both houses became Republican. Both houses flipped, really. They were both democratically controlled. Did you have any thoughts of what may occur once they actually started to take office in January of 2011?
Well, to be honest, I didn't see radical changes coming. In part, you know, I'd been living in Finland from January 2010 until the late October 2010. Mm. So I had planned it so I would come back at the end of October. I had a conference I had to go to, and then I wanted to be sure I could vote. So the national health care bill, the Tea Party explosion of the town hall meetings, all this was strange and distant. I mean, I was half a world away, you know, living in the Arctic. And I would read the news and I thought, oh, it can't be that bad. It can't be that bad. And then, then when Republicans were elected, in 2010, I thought, well, they're not going to do anything, you know, they're gonna play it safe. Why would they make waves? I was definitely wrong about that one. The turning point was when all the state unions negotiated contracts were rejected. You know, Walker was upping his tough talk on unions, and you know, I really thought, you know, he started doing this after he was elected, and he started making you know, threatening statements like to the state assembly and the state legislature, right? And he started saying things like, he was acting like he ran the state from November on. Mm. There were like 2 months there, you know, he was running the state, and you know, and that, I thought, wow, that's really arrogant to think that before he's in office, he has any power whatsoever. I watched online when the state contracts were rejected one by one. I heard only a few hours in advance that this was going to be bad. And, you know, then Russ Decker, Democrat, started voting no on them, which is just terrible. You know, the rumors, of course, were that he got a nice little buyout, you know, for voting the contracts down. But we can never really substantiate things like that. They know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. There's no rational reason. He didn't get along with Doyle very well, apparently. But a state contract being voted down, you know, that almost never happens. You know, the system's set up that that's a catastrophic situation. You know, the bargaining team, the OSER, who does the bargaining, is supposed to be empowered to make these decisions on behalf of the legislature, and then to vote down, that's really bad. So then things started escalating. We had an emergency membership meeting. I think this is in late November, early December, the TAA membership meeting, and a couple hundred people showed up. The room was just packed, standing room only. And we came up with sort of an emergency response team, you know, to try to strategize and be prepared for direct action. I think I actually made the motion to create like an ad hoc subcommittee of people looking for direct action. And some people in the room didn't like that I used the phrase direct action, and they wanted to rename the committee. It was just one of these long, sprawling meetings, but I just, you know, we recognized at that point that it was bad.
So, I didn't print off my chronology. I should have my chronology, but I believe an email came out from Governor Walker, might have been February 11th, about the budget repair bill and basically the voiding of current contracts. Mm-hmm. Do you recall when or where you were when you found out about this, and what was your immediate reaction?
Well, I was tipped off. Ron Blasco put it on his blog the Monday before the 14th. 14th was a Monday, so this would have been the 7th. On Monday, Blasco put on his... Do you know Ron Blasco?
Writes
for the Isthmus,
mm-hmm.
The conservative writer. He said, oh, something big's coming. And he didn't say what it was. He said, something huge is going to happen. And then, you know, we talked to everybody we knew. You know, we talked to AFT Wisconsin, who talked to the lobbyist Scott Spector, who would have talked to his Democratic friends in the State House. Everyone just said, you know, everyone, all the big wigs that we heard from, basically said, oh, he's just blowing smoke. Nobody's heard anything. What is Ron Blaskino? He likes to fan the flames. And then it got towards Wednesday of that week, and these rumors weren't going away. Then on Thursday night, we were starting to get pretty concerned. I think on Thursday sometime, we got a sneak peek in the TAA office. I was working there with the TAA staff, Rob Henn, Claiborne Hill, Peter Rickman, who's an activist and former co-president, Alex Hanno, one of the co-presidents, he was out of the country then. He was in Egypt. His family's from Egypt, and he was there. He was in Cairo, you know. Hmm. He went over to help with after the protests started in Cairo. He went over for a few weeks. I think Kevin Gibbons was there. But anyway, we were like four or five of us in a room in the office, and we got a call that sort of, you know, heard a rumor through the grapevine that there's this incredibly destructive union bill coming out, that this is real, that what Blaska posted. We started getting ready. It was really, you have four or five people sitting around like, oh my God, what are we gonna do? That's when we started working on it, I guess. I drove north for one day, but then I was only there one night, so I missed a little. I think because things were released on Friday. When I was driving north, I started seeing everything exploding. I saw the letter from the governor, so that I drove north on a Friday and I came back on Saturday early. And the whole time I was in the car, I was calling everyone in my cell phone, like, oh my God, you need to get ready. You know, I don't know what's happening. You know, everything's falling apart. It was quite a bit of chaos. That was the early time. But then through the weekend, I hadn't thought about that Thursday when we first found out, you know, the rumor. I hadn't thought about that for a long time. But yeah, we were working in the office. It got to be midnight, 2 a.m. And, you know, we had already planned this rally for Monday, this Valentine's Day rally, because we were anticipating huge budget cuts to UW. That was in the works since late January. We're all tired, you know, stressed, anxious, a little fearful. And we said, well, what do we do now? You know, it's late. And Peter Rickman said, you know, I think we should just go home right now. We said, we're going to need to get sleep, because we've got many, many long days ahead of us. And he was definitely right about that one.
There's something I want to ask that I think ran concurrent to this, and it may have been, and that's the... it only happened earlier this year. It's amazing that I can't think about it more clearly, but the idea of the new Badger partnership.
Oh, yeah.
I'm wondering if that was on the TAA's radar, or your radar, as this was going on, and what you knew about it and what your initial thoughts were about that, too.
Well, Biddy Martin proposed the new Badger partnership, and I was still in Finland, so it must have been September or October of 2010. TAA was talking about it. All fall. Then I think in January or late December, we were trying to sort through the details, but I mean, Biddy was being really evasive. You know, I mean, the fact is she was just lying to us, and she was lying to everyone about it. You know, this plan, I mean, she would say, this plan, we've been talking about these things for years, and then it's no surprise. This shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone that, you know, that we've been talking about these things for years. And then we say, well, what are your ideas? She'd say, well, we haven't really talked about it yet. In meantime, she did meeting after meeting after meeting where, you know, she, you know, would try to show how, you know, open this process has been. And then when we would press her for any hard details on what this NBP stuff is, she would say, well, it's all still being developed. This is just sort of a new idea. And so a bunch of the campus unions and probably some faculty organizations too, were able to get like a seat at the table to actually discuss this. And they drafted a document in December, I think, called the Principles for the New Badger Partnership, which they gave to Biddy. Because after we started pushing on her, it said, well, why haven't you invited us? You know, we have something called shared governance of this university, and we need to be a part of these discussions. And nobody knew anything. And so we drafted these things, which were never really honored. You know, the NBP, we were concerned about it. You know, one, we wanted hard details, and we wanted to be part of the process. And, you know, not just in an advisory role either. You know, an advisory role means that you guys can form an opinion on this, and then, you know, I'll do whatever I want. We also had concerns, like, about the potential for union busting. For example, you know, at the Institutes for Discovery, they said, well, their argument that the campus made, it was that they didn't need to hire union food service workers because it's not a campus building, because campus only paid part of the expense, and it's funded privately, this operation, so we cannot hire non-union workers. I mean, ethically, you know, unions find problems with that, and it's not a good precedent to set, you know. So anyway, that was another one of our concerns, and we're also concerned, I think that we're concerned about tuition hikes. Yeah, because it uncapped tuition rates. And we said, well, you know, the Board of Regents fixes tuition for good reason, and, you know, we don't want unprecedented tuition hikes. Undergraduates lots of us have funding and tuition remission, but for undergraduates too, the cost has gone so dramatically high in the last few years that, I mean, it's not affordable at all anymore. I think it's disgusting, really. Public education isn't open anymore, you know. So, which is, I mean, different from even 15 years ago when I went through. So much more affordable. So those were our concerns anyway. And then when it found out that she was, you know, basically in collusion with the governor, that didn't go over very well. And she had sworn members of the university committee to secrecy, you know, like loyalty oaths. That wasn't good either. So then there was this big backlash against it. Ultimately, I think that she never had the discussion that she needed to have, and she didn't give it time. She wanted to force it through quick because she was convinced it was the right thing for the university, but, you know, that's not how the University of Wisconsin runs historically. It's about open exchange of ideas and talking things through and, you know, building consensus, you know, with faculty and students and, you know. So, TAA voted to oppose the NBP, and I think for good reason too, for lots of those concerns.
I want to ask one more thing, and then I'm going to wrap it up for today, because I think we're at a point where we can start on Thursday with the Valentine's Day event and sort of roll it from there.
Yeah. I've got a lot of information.
Yeah. My question is, since we've talked a lot about Chancellor Martin, I'm going to assume, one should never assume, but I'm going to assume you know a little bit about her background as a graduate student here and as a member of the second TAA strike in 1980. So I'm wondering, either as a TAA in general or maybe you in particular, did you find her attitude towards the TAA different than what you thought it was going to be?
Yeah, it was. I mean, to be honest, I've met her, and she's a very nice person, and I like her personally. But I do think that I was disappointed. You know, I had, you know, optimistically and naively probably assumed that, you know, she would be slightly more union friendly than she was. One thing we did, you know, in the budget bill in 2008, a handful of us were able to win collective bargaining rights for research assistants, and immediately she was, you know, Team Biddy was on the defensive. They put up websites, sort of, you know, anti-unionization websites for RAs as a resource center, and, you know, these sorts of things. You know, ultimately it probably would. You know, what she didn't know, we weren't ready to organize RAs. There's 3,000 RAs on campus. We spent months and were able to get a list together, you know, and nonetheless find the, like, you know, what sort of rhetoric works. But she was right on the ball. Like, oh, research assistants have it so good. There's no need for unions, you know. It'll be interesting to see if that's still around on the WISC pages. I mean, she wasn't, I mean, I wasn't around during the natatorium thing, but, you know, I think maybe a little bit of bad blood formed there. We became a little bit of a thorn in her side, I think, because we wanted, you know, more transparency in what she wanted to do, and that wasn't really how she operated, you know. She sort of, you know, she was really good in, like, one-on-one situations with people and convincing individuals, but she had some process issues. So, you know, ultimately I was a little disappointed, I guess, because I sort of thought I'd have an activist chancellor. You know, TAA pushed, I mean, I think, I don't know if we formally endorsed her as the candidate to hire or not when they were doing the chancellor search a couple of years back, but, you know, I mean, I sort of thought we'd have a chancellor who would, you know, make bold statements and say, you know what, we are underfunded, what we do is important, you know, what we do generates revenue for the state, you know, every dollar of state money creates $21 and, in increased revenue for the state of Wisconsin when this money's put into the UW system. And she did some of that. She wasn't aggressive enough, I don't think. And, you know, and I was so disappointed. I mean, during the rallies, Jesse Jackson was standing outside of Bascom Hall and giving a speech. It was on April 4th, you know, when the Martin Luther King Day. And, you know, the day of his assassination, Jesse Jackson came, and he spoke to UW people, you know, and it was kind of last minute. It was a smallish crowd, maybe 100 people. But, you know, you have, you know, a great civil rights leader standing outside her office. Where is she? You know, that's not the sort of, you know, university leadership that I personally would like to have.
I always try to leave the narrator with the last word. So is there anything on your mind? And it can be something sort of post, something that went on in February and March that you're sort of, might be sort of percolating and you want to get it off your chest in case we don't get it. It might be something, you know, what happened before. Basically, is there anything on your mind that you want to get on the record before we close up shop for the day?
No, we're going to have more than an hour of stuff for Thursday.
Which is all right, which is probably good that we're meeting at 2:30. Just as long as I get back before 4-ish, we should be fine.
No, it all just kind of blends together. I think I'm good.
Okay. All right. Well, this concludes the first interview with Tim Frandy. Tim, thank you very much. Right. All right. Today is September 29th, 2011. This is the second interview with Tim Frandy. Again, we're here at Memorial Library. And again, I am Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. And we're interviewing Tim about the project we're calling Capitol Protests 2011, the protests on the in and around the Capitol in February and March of 2011. So, Tim, when we left off, we were talking about the February 11th. Sort of that weekend building up to the first event. The question I'd like to ask to get us going is, from what I remember you saying, the February 14th event was going to happen anyway. But then the Governor Walker's email came out. Did that change? Obviously, I mean, it changed a lot of things, but did it change the basic idea of that February 14th event?
Yeah, it wasn't a hard tweak. I think that what we had planned was this I Heart UW rally because everybody knew that, you know, big budget cuts were coming, you know, over 10%. And, you know, I know it varies place by place and, you know, in the university, but there's like a lot of grad students who have like photocopy limits, you know. Mm-hmm. They're allowed to make one photocopy per student per week, you know, one page, and then everything else comes at their own expense. And so, you know, I mean, we're totally, like in the humanities, we're totally resource deprived. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Over in the med school, you know, they have pharmaceutical companies bringing in free lunch for them every day, but mm-hmm. you know, we don't have coffee, you know. And anyway, you know, we don't want budget cuts, of course, mm-hmm. and we're pretty strapped already. So this Valentine's Day thing, it was planned as a, you know, don't cut UW funding. You can even find the image online if you Google I Heart UW. It was a two-sided like half sheet handout. And the idea was that it was Valentine's and a bunch of TAA and undergrad folk, and I believe lots of professors signed these Valentines too. We're going to deliver them to the governor's office. And then on the 11th, when, you know, we'd already organized and sort of planned this, we sort of tweaked it a little bit to be a, it was still mostly a, you know, a rally and not a protest. Though, of course, the tone was shifting pretty dramatically. Mm-hmm. And people realized how serious this was. So, and there was a... Peter Rickman did a lot of the speaking during that. And you can find media clips of him from the 14th that were posted. He gave a great sort of stump speech about how, you know, kind of poking fun at how Governor Walker's going to be a heartbreaker on Valentine's Day, you know. And but you know, he had this great soundbite. He said, "Well, this is not a protest. It's a rally to show our love for higher ed in the state." And you know, we didn't want to deviate from message because we didn't know at first. I mean, we had no way of telling what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, to be honest, I think most of us at that point anticipated, I mean, this is what I anticipated, that we'd have our rally, and I think we turned out about 1,500, which is the biggest rally anybody'd seen in the Capitol for a while, I think. Well, there was a big anti-Walker thing in January, but I missed that. anyway, it was a pretty good rally for us. And, I mean, you know, we had envisioned the Wisconsin AFL-CIO was planning 2 days of rallies. And, you know, I sort of figured, well, maybe if we're lucky we get like 5,000-8,000 people to show up and then they go home and then we do it 2 or 3 times and then what? You know, because that's the nature of a rally. Show up, there's some speeches, people cheer, and then they go home and nothing really changes. But, you know, it turned out to be much different, you know, mm-hmm. obviously, mm-hmm. than that.
So, after the 2:14 event, mm-hmm. and then, of course, all this came about the same weekend as a few days before with the email and the basic shell of what the budget repair bill was like. When did the TA, or what was in the mindset of the TA about what was going to be? I mean, you said sort of what your initial thoughts were, but what did the TAA start to do after February 14th to, I guess, sort of change? You know, you talk about this is not a protest, this is a rally. Mm-hmm. It becomes a protest pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
So how does that change? From your memory and your experience in it, how does the TAA start to change tact or tactics?
I think it became a protest as soon as it... I mean, it's kind of just semantic splitting hairs, you know. But, you know, we're always vigilant of the message, the public message. You know, there were people working the crowds to make as soon as like the Walker equals Hitler signs started coming out, we had people working the crowds and saying, we don't need that sort of sign, you're hurting us more than helping us, because the media is picking up on this and making us look like a bunch of idiots. So I mean, there's always this message control that's kind of done informally, you know, and you can't convince everyone, you know. I mean, I guess we kind of knew it was going to go to a protest at some point, but I think the telling moment for me anyway was when I started seeing initial poll numbers come in and saying that, you know, 60-65% of Wisconsinites think that public employees should have the right to have unions, you know, and only like 30% supported Walker's legislation. Then you know that the public's got your back and you're doing things right, and then you can get a little bit more aggressive in your tact and messaging and tactics and messaging, I think. I don't know if that's... I think you're asking me something else and I'm answering a different question.
Well, let's sort of talk logistics then, because at some point the TAA takes up residence inside the Capitol.
Yeah, that happened.
So why don't we talk about either your direct involvement or indirect involvement in that, and maybe go from there.
Okay. Well, so for the 15th, so we had this rally on the 14th, and, you know, we're happy with it, and we're tickled pink that the Badger Herald picked it up and even made the Isthmus, the Daily Page website, and we're kind of giddy about that. And then we went back to the office, and we worked long into the night. And I was organizing that night. I don't remember exactly what I was doing. I was calling people. I had done this database work because. For 2 years, like, we didn't have the best membership secretaries who took care of our records of our members, so a lot of cards had not been entered. Like some, maybe up to like 800 cards, membership cards, with, you know, addresses and phone numbers and emails and names and all these things. They weren't properly maintained. So me and one of my friends, Jason Schroeder, basically sat down and we entered all of them by hand. into a spreadsheet, which took like 2 days, like 20 hours or something of work, you know, times two. Quite a time-consuming process. And then we're making these call lists, and then we'd get these pages done, and then people would start making calls and, you know, saying, you know, alerting our members that, you know, something terrible is happening. And a lot of people didn't know, you know. I think that's what I was doing on the 14th. I remember the office was filled with people that were making signs. They'd been making signs for days. You know, first it was Valentine's Day signs, and I remember some undergrads were making the Slack Kids, a student labor action coalition, mostly undergrad activist types, and they're using our office and making spray painted banners of like the Imperial Walker images and things like that. So the next day, we knew that there was going to be this public testimony. The Joint Finance Committee is required to hold public testimony on any bill that they consider. And according to customary practice, what they've always done is they listen to public testimony on any bill until there's no more to be heard. And we knew that there were going to be busloads of maybe up to 10,000 people or whatnot coming for these rallies. And we thought, well, people are coming in from all over the state, people have families, you know, what we can do strategically being TA is we're going to wait until we're going to get a big block of people to show up late. Because at 9 o'clock the rallies will be done, people will be going home, and then a whole bunch of TA folks will show up dragging everyone we can to do these public testimonies. And so I think from this, because then from it was from this thing that we thought, well, we're going to make them stay there as late as we can, all night if we can, you know. And so then I love this. My Alex Hanna, who's the current co-president of the TAA, he created a Facebook group called Sleep With Your TA and invited all these undergrads to, or Sleep With The TA, and invited undergrads and said, we're going to come to the Capitol late, bring your sleeping bags, bring your pillows, it's going to be an all-night thing. And, you know, we didn't know what was going to happen, you know, we were getting ready for the chance that we might try to occupy it, and we thought if we have the numbers, and we need to, we're going to be ready to occupy it and or get arrested. So, so people were testifying all day, and I don't even remember what I was doing. I was working in the office. In the TAA office, probably doing more of this data stuff and phone call stuff. And then around 9 o'clock, I think, maybe it was about 8:45, we got a call from inside the Capitol to the office, and it said, everybody's got to get here now. They're going to lock the doors at 9, or they're going to stop hearing people testify at 9, so everyone has to get on the list. And then, you know, they were going to lock the Capitol doors, and we couldn't get in. They were going to try to cut it off. So, I don't know. We had a dozen people or so, maybe 20 people in the office. And we quick locked up, and everyone, I mean, we literally sprinted to the Capitol up State Street and to get in line so we could get in, you know, get in the Capitol, get in line, and testify. And try to keep this thing going all night. And we packed the line, which had been pretty steady and constant the whole day. And the line just, you know, all of a sudden there were 100 or more people waiting in line. And they started going on. People would fill up these little cards, and you could only testify once, and you had like 3 minutes to talk. And, well, it turned out I was the last person to fill one out before they cut it off. I got to the front of the line, I filled out mine, and they said, somebody came out from the office where they're doing the hearings, they said, that's it, no more. And then, fortunately for me, I'm not much of a yeller, but fortunately for me, there were the crowd of people who were able to, you know, push up to the front and get irate about it and such, and I remember I was very relieved that I didn't have to make too big of a scene, because I don't like doing that too much. Like Adrienne Padgett, who's a co-president, I remember she came up and got right in somebody's face, and so I was happy about that. So then we're in the hallway, and then people started flooding into this tiny little hallway, because the word got out to the rotunda what had just happened, and people from the rotunda started flooding in, and we jammed this hallway, and people started yelling, you know, kill the bill, or, you know, let us in, stuff like that. And we yelled louder and louder, and they had in the rotunda this giant television. And I was only in the hallway, but apparently there was this giant television in the rotunda so people could watch the hearings. And somebody came running in from the rotunda. We were yelling, and somebody came in and waved their arms and got our attention, and they said, they started yelling, it's working, they can hear you, chant louder. And so everyone got louder, and this went on for like 45 minutes. But we disrupted them so much that, I mean, they couldn't function. It was just driving them crazy. Because the Republicans just wanted to go home, and then the Democrats wanted to draw it out as long as they could. And so Representative Taylor, she's from southern Milwaukee area, I think. Okay. Lena Taylor.
Okay.
She came out and asked us to please be quiet for a while because she was trying to negotiate with Republicans, and she was trying to, you know, broker a deal to keep the testimony going, and they agreed to testify and to take testimony until 2 a.m. And then the Republicans said that they'd only do that, and then they were going to walk and try to cram the bill through. I mean, the whole plan is to get the bill through by Thursday anyway, you know. It got to 2, and they walked, and they didn't even come close to getting my name. And then there was a press conference that the Democrats had at that time in the rotunda, and the basic understanding was that their position was that, you know, the Republicans walked, and now the Democrats will continue to take, you know, the people's testimony, you know, all, as long as it takes. And so, but the crowds needed that because we needed the political cover, because we were all. There's a law that says as long as there's a meeting going on, the public is welcome in the Capitol. I don't know if it's a law, it's some sort of, you know, policy. Mm-hmm. And so they said we're continuing to meet, you know, even though it wasn't the official meeting. They kept taking testimony, which gave, you know, people in the rotunda the cover to stick around. So that's how the occupation started. Then that first night, then they went, they took a little break, they started taking more testimony. And the first night, everyone is exhausted, and somehow everyone just went to sleep. And I got stuck with, I was the only one up, and they needed more people to testify. So it was like me and one other person. And my job that first night was to wake people up and tell them to go testify, which was one of the most horribly painful things I've ever had to do, you know? Everyone was exhausted. You'd shake them and say, I'm so sorry. We need people to testify right now. Go, go. And So I did that from like 3 until about 6:30 in the morning. Woke people up. And then people started waking up on their own. That first night I was up for like 40 hours or something without any sleep. I was up the whole first night, I didn't even lie down. And then I was up all the next day, and I didn't go to bed until like midnight the second day, and I slept pretty good on the marble floor then.
So I have a timeline here. This all sort of conflates in my mind. When did the 14
leave? I think it was that Thursday.
Okay.
Because the first day there was a JFC meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Or the first day it was the testimony. Then the second day was the JFC vote, probably.
Okay.
And then it was the assembly vote on that Thursday. Then the senators probably left then. And that Thursday was a huge day. That was the day that I felt like we actually had some real momentum for the first time.
Okay. What are your memories, sleep-addled memories of the Thursday then, where you feel like momentum actually starts?
Well, you know, the thing that sticks out there are a few things that it was the 14 leaving that was the big thing. I mean, I suppose it could have been Wednesday, but my memory says it was Thursday.
Yeah, I think you're right.
There were a couple things. I'd have to look at my photos. I think the what happened is this. This is why Thursday felt so important to me. Because the 14 left, and I don't have a lot to say about that. You know, the rumors swirled around that the 14 had left. Then I saw a few news reports. I mean, lots of the time that first week, I was doing media control stuff because, I don't mean to make it sound more important than it was, but all the mainstream media was starting to pick us up. I mean, by like that Thursday, Friday, I don't know when it came out. Kevin Gibbons, who was the other co-president last year, he was like on the front page of the LA Times. They did a big story on us, you know, on the TAA. We're flattered. I mean, but then, like on Thursday, I bet it was like that Thursday when we started to be picked up in London and out in Al Jazeera. And, you know, it was like, wow, you know, suddenly this is just not, I mean, 3 days earlier, it was like, ooh, the isthmus, you know? And then, like, we're in every newspaper in the country and all, so many around the world, you know? And I was, within the first 2 weeks, I mean, I did an interview, I did these quotes that were translated in Swedish for a newspaper, you know, in Norway, you know, I did an article for a paper. For a literary journal on the protest, you know, these things started like picking up, and everyone was using their talents to do, you know, to disseminate information worldwide. But the problem was that, like, you know, the national media has paid no attention to Wisconsin politics, state politics, and so you'd read NBC News or whatever, CNN, and it would say things like, "Well, the unions don't really want to have their benefits cut." And then Scott Walker says there's a financial crisis. And, you know, we'd already done our homework. We knew that, you know, the state was it, you know, yes, the state had a slight debt problem, but compared to the other states, we were right in the middle of the pack. We were like the 23rd best state for financial situation. You know, we're totally average. We didn't have a real type crisis. It was trumped up. Then, we tried to message on that. We tried to find these facts. He said, well, public employees get these gold-plated insurance and pension plans. Like, well, okay, so we had people researching that. We drag up this information that, you know, trace the statistics to, the only people ever done stats on this were, you know, funded by unions, as far as I know. But, I mean, there are studies, which I trust, I guess. said that public employee, you know, they get about like 8% less when you compensate for education, you know, than private sector employees. So, you know, we're trying to get that all this sort of information out, you know. And it was an ongoing thing. So, you know, I was emailing journalists and trying to, like, articulate our side. And I was, you know, trying to find good stories and spread them on Facebook and that sort of thing. I think the other thing that happened on Thursday was the day that we tried to block doors. And probably that Wednesday we had a TAA meeting inside the Capitol, and I don't even remember who they are, some national folks from AFL-CIO. I mean, geez, like Randy Weingarten showed up to our meetings, and Richard Trumka, and Randy Weingarten's the president of AFT National. Richard Trumka is head of the AFL-CIO. He's a great speaker. I like Richard Trumka a lot. But they showed up at our meetings, you know, which was kind of surreal, you know, and, you know, tried to rally us up and whatnot. They're getting us ready they wanted us to go and get arrested and such, I think. But it's hard to, it made for a really kind of awkward, intense dynamic too, you know, when people you don't know are coming in and saying, okay, go get arrested, you know. And, you know, for us, you know, our average income for grad employees is right at the poverty line, you know, $12,000, $13,000 a year. And, you know, it's that $300-$400 is a lot of money, you know. Mm-hmm. That's half a month of income. Mm-hmm. So, so I blocked some doors that day, too. I blocked one in particular. I was doing a lot of the media organizing stuff. I was sitting in the hallway near a plug-in, near the TA war room. And, you know, periodically, we had launched this Defend Wisconsin site, and they were using Twitter feeds to mobilize people and get them in front of certain doors. So, you know, block, you know, whatever, 330 South right now, you know, and then a flood of people would go and block that door. I mean, the idea is that so if you block the doors, then they can't, the politicians can't get into the room and meet to hold a vote. So that's why we're blocking doors. One of my favorite stories that happened to me was that you know, there was a real shortage of people in front of one door. So it was on Twitter, and then people said, yeah, it's real, we need people there now. So, you know, I dropped my stuff and just went to the door. And this was another thing. I mean, the crowd in there, you know, I have left my backpack with my laptop in it unattended so many times. And it was so dumb. I have my whole dissertation. It wasn't even backed up. My whole dissertation, my whole academic career of writing on my computer, and the number of times I just left it sitting out, you know, and I'd be on the other side of the building. I mean, it's amazing what, I mean, it says a lot about the crowd, you know. It's remarkable, really. But, you know, it's what you had to do, too. I mean, if I'm blocking a door and, you know, things could get ugly, then I don't want to have it smashed either. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so I went over and I blocked the door, and there was some scare tactics. People were circulating little notes around that said, what to do if you're arrested and how you're going to be charged with a crime. And I don't even know who was circulating these things. I think that there were conservative groups just to spook people, you know, about the fact that they might get arrested, but I could be wrong. So I was sitting in front of, I got in front of this door, and there was someone, I don't remember, I don't think I knew who the person was, but, I mean, they were doing the body mobilization stuff, you know, gave very specific instructions on what to do, you know. We'd sit together, and then if somebody came up, you know, we're supposed to get closer together and lock arms, and, you know, told us how to position our body and make sure that nobody got through. And he said, well, where we are now, we're blocking like half of the hallway. He said, what we think is going to happen is somebody's going to come up this elevator, and so you have to block the elevator. And he said, we've got people on the floors below us, and they're just sitting in the open elevator doors, and they're not moving. So the doors are not... The door should not be going anywhere. But if for some reason these people do move, we're pretty sure that they're going to come up the elevator because that's the one way that they'll have easiest access to get into this room that you're protecting. And I sat there, you know. This is 3-4 days in. I hadn't left the Capitol. Maybe I left the Capitol to get coffee a couple times, but I really didn't leave that first week. Once I went home to shower, people didn't smell so good, you know, and your teeth just felt fuzzy and awful, and so I was sitting next to the door, and I was sitting really close to all these other people, and uncomfortable, and tired, and sweaty, and everyone's smelling bad, and we sit there for like an hour, nothing's happening, you know, just doing whatever, you know, it is that we do, passing the time, I guess. And suddenly somebody looks up and they notice that the elevator has changed a floor. It was on basement, now it's on one. And it's a really slow-moving elevator. So everyone like gasped and crowds in together and locks arms and gets ready. And it goes to two. We're on three. We're still waiting. This whole thing felt like it took 5 minutes, you know. And I looked over to the people who are blocking the door, and it's like a bunch of like 100-pound 18-year-old girls. And I was pretty close to them too. I thought, oh shit. These girls are not going to be able to like outmuscle police officers. Like, you know, I thought, what am I going to do? I'm going to have to kind of jump in there and I don't know, you know. I thought it was going to be ugly. Three. Door opens very slowly. And there's no police officers, but instead there's a woman in a wheelchair holding a sign that says Walker equals Hitler. So, yeah, not exactly what we expected.
Oh, that is a great story, though.
We took her out. She got out of the elevator. We put her right in front of the door to make sure that, if any cops do come through, then they'd have to push over a woman in a wheelchair to get to the room.
You mentioned a couple different times Facebook, and one of the specific questions we have is the idea of really, how did Facebook and other social media influence the protests? I wonder if you want to elaborate a little bit more on protests these days, whether it's here or... in other parts of the world, the word gets out quickly because of that.
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. It's, it's the new reality, I guess, of social unrest, which, I mean, it's a fantastic tool. I mean, we need people to block the doors, and somebody sends out a tweet that says, I don't even use Twitter, you know, but I got on it just so I can follow these things, but, you know, block this door, and, you know, people know right away. The downside is that it can become quite a rumor mill, and I think there was a lot of intentional deception that used to spread bad information. I mean, the rumors that were flying on the floor were just crazy, you know. Everyone was going to be arrested every single day, and the craziest one I heard is that the Teamsters were coming to push around public union employees, and that didn't really make any sense. The Teamsters did show up, but they, you know, super supportive. I don't know. They have a reputation for violence, you know, but yeah, there were some strange things going around. The thing that I thought was important. I mean, the Twitter was important for mobilizing people on Facebook, but it was the ability to you know, I mean, you might say it sort of democratizes like the media process a little bit, because the media coverage was so bad, and so much bad information. I mean, the national media got the story wrong time after time after time. And then you have this Wisconsin State Journal and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, both of which are very conservative papers, and they were blatantly misrepresenting things. I mean, on purpose too, I think. I vowed never to buy either paper again during that time because I felt their coverage was so atrocious. Both endorsed Walker. And both were convinced, you know, and they've sort of mellowed, I think, since we realized that how wildly unpopular this was. But they were no friends of you know, protesters, especially early on. One thing I saw, you know, PolitiFact, right? It's run out of Florida, but so, you know, there was a time in the protest, this was further on, but like, you know, tell the story to talk about a little bit about media, you know, and how it represents things that go on. You know, one of the issues that we're having is that, well, after they locked down the Capitol about 3 weeks in, two weeks in maybe they locked down the Capitol, it's really hard to get in and out. So, you know, we started opening bathroom windows and such and sneaking pizzas in, and people would go, you know, climb through the bathroom windows to get into the Capitol. That's a pretty normal occurrence. And so what the Department of Administration did is they started putting bolts in the windows to make sure that they didn't open. Literally. There are photos of bolts, them installing bolts in the windows so they can't open. And then, you know, some Democrats complained to the media that they're bolting the windows shut, which literally they were doing. And PolitiFact evaluated the statement that they're bolting the windows shut, and they declared it pants on fire lying. Even though they were literally bolting the windows shut. They said, well, just because they're bolting the windows shut doesn't mean that they're actually bolting the windows shut. Don't you, if you had a state capitol building, wouldn't you keep your windows locked too? But like, no, literally, there were, I mean, you know, it was a very, I see what they're saying, that maybe it's a normal security measure, but to declare a pants on fire lie, the worst type of lie, that what they're doing is literally bolting the window shut. I mean, it was just, you know, it's intolerable coverage. So anyway, so I mean, I think that, trying to get the message, you know, right in state, trying to spread it out of state, trying to get the filter this message to the media, because we knew at whatever point we realized that this is going to be won in, you know, public opinion, court of public opinion, and not through a legal process. You know, we weren't going to sway anyone. That was a realization that occurred at some point. So, yeah.
So, I was trying to look here on the timeline and see what what day it was that they might have been. It says Wisconsin authorities back away on Sunday, February 27th, from a threat to evict hundreds of labor rights demonstrators.
Yes, that was a Sunday. I wasn't there on that day. I tried to get in, but I was the doors were locked, or the lines were too long to get in. They started putting up the. And if it was, they probably had security screens going on at that point, and that made it difficult to get in for me.
I remember, again, not to get too much of me on here, but I gave a presentation for the academic staff yearly conference. They don't call it that, but it's, and that way it was at the hotel just down off the square. And so I went in, and that was Friday the 25th. And at that point, it was still, they were funneling people into specific doors, but there wasn't metal detectors yet. So I think it was that weekend where the sort of the, if you want to call it a crackdown, crackdown started. Another thing, a couple of things I want to ask, and this again, you know, might get to specific anecdotes, it might just get to general opinions, is you talk about, and you mentioned this when we met without the recorder, that you took photos of this, and this is a very well, in a sense, it's a very well documented protest, because again, the times that we live in, you know, as you mentioned before, you have a field recording kit
right
in your phone,
exactly,
or flip, you know, the flip video or whatever. My specific question though is, did you come a time where you sort of realized that this was not only a current political event, but also a uniquely historical event? And even though you're not a historian per se, you, I want to ask it this way, why did you decide to take pictures?
Well, I would say that I started taking pictures maybe around the 14th, because I could tell that there was a difference, you know. I've done labor stuff in the past, and it's, you know. And I always sort of recognized what was happening was interesting and important and worth documenting, but at the same time, I didn't want the documenting of it to obstruct from my participation in it. You know, I wanted to, you know, it was more important that I was there as an activist than as an ethnographer. You know, there are moments that, you know, sort of stand out, you know, is where you realize it's important. I remember as in the working in the union office, you see the 13th or 14th that would say on the photos, and I started taking some photos because there were so many people in the office, you know, I was there, you know, all day long and such, and so, you know, I always take my shoes off when I'm at the office and want to be comfortable, so my shoes were off, and I had to like tiptoe around people and step over people, and you could barely walk through the office because there were so many people working. And then I was like, wow, this is amazing. Look at all these people, you know, working together and doing everything they possibly can. And so I took some photos of that. And then when we marched on the 14th, you know, when we marched on the Capitol, we had, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 people. And, or as the media reported, dozens of people. Another reason why the media was lacking. Yeah. Dozens of people showed up. They took some video clips of when we entered the Capitol building. Entering the Capitol for the first time was a pretty intense experience because I hadn't seen that many people in the State House, you know, inside, because you can make a lot of noise in there. When you're on State Street and you're yelling, like, the sound just goes away, but it really can fill up the rotunda. So, you know, there are various points like that, I guess. And then, you know, it was that Thursday, right? Once the Democratic senators left, you knew that was important. It was more than just a protest. It was historic at that point, because at least some politicians listened, you know, and responded, you know, in this fashion. And there was also a moment, because in the first night or two of the occupation, it was small. The first night, I would guess there were about 150, 200 people there, max. It was quite small, as largely TAA and undergrads. The Wednesday night, I don't remember so well because I was asleep. But by Thursday, lots of that first week, I was up till 3 in the morning and then up awake at 6. You know, I didn't get much rest at all, and. I wasn't on the floor so much. I wasn't, you know, I did a little yelling and stuff, but I was doing more organizing, you know, away from the crowds, and trying to get people to come and control, do, you know, work with the messaging. But the third night, things started changing, you know, and that's, you know, the high school kids were marching at that point, and the high school kids would come, you know, the Madison schools were closed. I think the TAA had started the teach-outs at that point, and things were getting to be pretty intense. And so I remember, because on the floor, I was upstairs, and it was probably like midnight or 2 in the morning, and people came up, and they're like, oh, there's all these high school kids. I don't know what to do. These high school kids, they're drinking, they're smoking pot in the bathrooms, like they're drinking openly on the floor. And like I tell them, you know, you guys have to take this someplace else. You can't do this in here. And, you know, they just don't care. And so a few of us got together, and I was relieved I didn't have to do it. I said, you know, I was busy with something else. And I said, well, can you go around as a group and, like, you know, like, nicely ask them to like, you know, if they're going to drink or whatever, take it outside, you know, do it someplace else, like, do it in the bathroom in secret, just don't. Because, I mean, we thought, you know, the national media is not our friend, state media isn't our friend, like, they find out that one, you know, high school kid smoking pot in the bathroom of the Capitol, and then we're just a bunch of, like, you know, radical, lazy hippies who are corrupting the youth of this country. So, you know, it took on a life of its own. That was the point when I realized that this thing was no longer, like, controllable. And that's when the drum circle and the Capital City community really started moving in. And we started seeing, like, the presence of the medics and the, you know, the info desk crowd, and then the daycare center popped up around that time period. And, you know, people played these different sort of social roles. And it started to be something quite different than, you know, what the first couple nights anyway. It was a little frightening, you know. It's hard not to have control over this large thing. And, you know, in the beginning I felt largely responsible for it. You know, because I've been active for a long time. I knew a lot of people involved with, like, those over the initial night. You know, I was up on, I was talking to one of the Capitol Police that night. He said, yeah, you know, there were some windows broken. You know, there was a little bit of vandalism. And, you know, I was trying to work them a little bit and just, you know, say, you know, I said, those aren't our people. I don't know who did that. You know, our people are under control. You know, we don't do stuff like that. If you have problems, you know, bring it to me. I'll talk to people, you know. This is before we had the whole Marshall system going, you know, where people were... It's a great, you know, it's a good, you know, the Marshall system.
Yeah, yeah. But if you want to elaborate about it at this point, that would be good.
I wasn't terribly involved with marshalling, but, you know, the some of the various members of unions would, they wear like a blaze color jersey, and then their goal was to negotiate between the crowds and the police officers. It helps keep the peace. That way, if somebody in the crowd is getting rowdy, somebody who's clearly identified as an ally will, you know, try to get them to calm down rather than having a police officer do it, which tends to be more antagonistic because there's more authority power issues that happen there. You know, I had to do some of the, you know, calming people down. It was really... That's not my favorite thing either, you know. No Fox News camera recording people, like, working themselves up and getting red in the face, angry and screaming, and, you know. You just can't have that, you know. You have to be careful around cameras, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Could you talk a bit more about what you mentioned earlier, the TA war room?
Yeah.
You know, where it was,
yeah,
and maybe a bit about how it came to be, and then... maybe how it, sort of its initial war room, and if it did change over time, how it changed over time.
I think it was 230 Northeast. maybe, is the room number in the Capitol. It's written down someplace, I can get you the exact number. I'm not sure. Eventually, at some point, probably a Democratic ally said, here, you can use this room. Go up to this room, and you can gather in here and use it for, you can plug in your, you can leave your stuff here, you can sleep here, do whatever you need to in this space. So people brought in wireless routers and such, and we made it, you know, because there was internet access, then, you know, people congregated there. And there aren't many outlets in the Capitol. And you need, I mean, like, when I was there, I was working on my laptop constantly, you know, doing the stuff I needed to do. And so you need constant power support source, you know. And so there weren't very few places in the Capitol you could go. I mean, there's no outlets in that building. And so everyone kind of gathered in this room. I was there a little bit. It got weird, though. Just about everyone there, I mean, it got to be this really high, strung, intense sort of place. It was so unpleasant in there because it was so filled with this sort of tension. Maybe not everyone would agree with me, but I've heard many people say that it was way too aggressive in there. But so I eventually moved out into the hallway because there was an outlet in the hallway right outside the room. So I could be, you know, working near there and I could grab the people I wanted. But then I didn't have to actually sit in the room more than I needed to. Let's see, what else about that room? I found it more frustrating than anything. I mean, like I told you before, you know, I've been active for a really long time. I knew everything. And then there were lots of, like, strangers who would kind of just wander into the room. So at some point, somebody or other put somebody at the door, somebody I didn't know at the door, to, like, try to, like, keep people out of the room. You know, so I tried to walk in the room one time to be like, who are you? Why are you coming in here? I said, get out of my way, you know, you don't know who anyone is, you know? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I didn't mean to be an ass about it. I tried to be, like, I belong in here, really, trust me. So it got frustrating, because then you had, I mean, for me personally, and, you know, there were lots of, you know, sort of young upstarts who thought they knew everything about everything, and they wanted to help, and they were given these jobs, but they haven't been too active, and, you know, but tensions were running high anyway, so just part of the normal daily life there, you know, little spats and conflicts that, you know, you just have to hug out or whatever.
Another thing I want to ask, you mentioned the sort of the liaison between the police and the crowd.
Mm-hmm. Marshals.
The police themselves, a couple of the folks that I've talked to who were part of the 60s and 70s, their sort of general comment was it was interesting to be a part of something where the police appeared to be on our side. And so my general question is just, you know, in your own personal, you mentioned one little anecdote there, but your own personal experience with law enforcement in and around the Capitol.
Well, the police are on our side. The one officer, you know, that first night when I was up all night, I spent a lot of time with one or two Capitol policemen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he recognized me. Weeks later, he recognized me. I bet he'd still remember me. I remember what his face looks like. You know, we made an impression on each other that night, I guess. I think they were definitely on our side. You know, I really empathize for, you know, with the hard job that they had trying to maintain the peace. And, I didn't always agree with everything they did, but, you know, not like acting violently, right? Like, you know, they looked the other way a lot. They could have been a little more active, but, you know, I don't understand the dynamic of their workplace and what. I mean, Chief Tubbs is like in trouble now. Like, isn't Steve Nass going after him for trying to get him fired because he was too permissive or something? So, you know, really, I have nothing but empathy for their situation. I had a few fun conversations. I mean, one time, when was this? This was around April 4th, I think. This is about when the senators, when did the senators come back? Was that around, that was March 12th?
I think so.
Yeah. There was a huge rally. The Democrats came back. There was the vote. There's nothing we could do.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was then, though I could get the exact date for you if I thought about it a little bit more.
It's March 12th is definitely a Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
So
I could link it to a photograph I have, but we're trying. Yes. No. Darn it. So it was March 9th that we stormed the Capitol. Right. Then March 10th, there was a vote.
As word spread, the vote was coming. Hundreds of protesters moved in the building before its official 6 p.m. closing.
Right.
That's Wednesday, March 9th.
Yeah. So it was that Thursday that they passed the bill in committee.
Mm-hmm.
And so on that Thursday, that's when the protesters were dragged out from the Senate antechamber, right?
I think so.
And so I stormed in because the Capitol had been locked down for a couple days. And I got in on the 8th for the first time in several days because it was locked on that Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And the preceding Sunday. And so I was in. I slept there. The last night I slept there. And then that next day, I was sitting in the antechamber. And then, you know, nothing seemed to be happening. And so I walked out. Somebody said, you know, we should really, like, survey the Capitol grounds. Like, we've all been sitting in this antechamber, like, all night long and sleeping here, and, like, why couldn't they do this in the assembly room, like, right on the other side of the Capitol? And I said, well, that's a really good point, but I think I'm going to go and, like, walk the perimeter and try to listen to some cops and see what, you know, they have, if anything's going on over on that side, you know, make sure that there's no obvious plan, because nobody was over there. And we're a small crew again, you know? And so I walked around and I went over and listened to some police officers, and then things started getting rowdy and they started dragging people out. I was back with it over near them when they were dragging people out. I couldn't get in again, but as they were dragging people out, then I could only take it for so long. It was really painful to be there for that. So, you know, the crowd didn't know what to do. Lots of people were getting angry. Some people got hurt when they were being dragged out. That wasn't fun. Then you know, the crowd started singing "We Shall Overcome," which made everything just even more, like, you know, horribly painful to endure, you know. So anyway, I was there for as long as I could take it, which is, you know, quite a while. And then I walked over. I thought, I have to get out of this crowd. I need just a break. This is too intense, you know. People screaming, you know, the physical stuff that's going on, the singing, you know.
Yeah.
So I went over to the other side to catch my breath and, you know, clear my head for a few minutes. And then there were a bunch of police officers on the other side, and I was listening in to see if I could learn anything. You know, they're talking on their walkie-talkies, and I went up and started talking to one. I said, you know, good day to be working on this side of the Capitol, mm-hmm. huh? And he looked at me, got a big smile on his face, and said, yep. they didn't want to talk much, but they were obviously very relieved that they weren't having to move bodies that day. But, you know, all that said, the different officers too had different roles. Like, when the Capitol Police became less important and the DOA started looking for more state troopers coming in from out of the city. I don't know this, but I'm pretty sure that they were cherry-picked for their political leanings to come and serve in the Capitol, because there were random people who came from all over the state, and they were mean. You know, they were not friendly. These were the people that were watching the doors, and, like, you know, people who had identification to go in there, like Democratic staffers, and they were just denied, you know. No, you can't come in. You know, people who work in the building couldn't get in, you know, and that was the state troopers who were doing that, and you know that's why I think that they were, you know, cherry picked a bit. So, yeah, that was. They actually confiscated people's ID, because people would have these like badges or whatever that they could work in the building, and the troopers would say, "Oh, let me take a look at that," and they'd grab it and then they'd walk away with it and just steal them. Then you don't have ID to get in the building, you know. Mm-hmm. Then there. What's better? I saw that when they started using the tunnels too, they had hired a private security firm to guard the entrances of the tunnels, and they were assholes. there's some great like underground like videos of these private security companies who guarded the tunnel doors. And, you know, I forget who it was. I think I met her once or something. And there was a YouTube video she did. Just, you know, she went out with a camera and started recording this conversation she had with these guys. And she asked them who they worked for. They said they were police officers. And she asked if she could see identification. And they said that she had no right to ask for identification. She said, "Well, that's funny, because police officers have to show identification." And he said, "You better get out of here or I'm going to arrest you." And she said, "How can you arrest me if you're not a police officer?" And he said, "This is private property. You have to leave. I'll arrest you." She said, "This is the parking garage. I'm parked right over here. Why can't I be in here?" And, you know, they kept going back and forth like this. Yeah, so they were them, too.
You talk about some of these later Saturday rallies, like the, I think it was the March 12th rally that when the 14 returned. Mm-hmm. There was also, and that, I don't know if that was the same day as the tractors that drove around.
That was the tractorcade.
That was tractorcade day. Was there a different vibe on the weekend, especially as this sort of went along and more people would come on the weekend than during the week?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think we always looked forward to the weekends, because then, you know, we knew the crowds would be bigger. I think, you know, all things said and done, the real excitement occurred over the course of, like, 6 weeks. The first week I was super involved. The second week I caught that nasty flu that went around. And so I was at home a lot that week, and then I was back the third week. But I looked forward to the weekends, because I knew I could catch a break and catch up with my own work a little bit. Because I thought, oh, people, the rallies are fine. My body does not have to be in this position. I can, you know, prep for teaching. I can grade the stuff I need to grade.
Mm-hmm.
And but I mean, I showed up at the tractorcade day and such, but you know, I usually just showed up and hung out for a while and marched a little bit and then went home.
There's at least one more thing I want to ask you today, and then I want to,
yeah,
you know, reserve the right to sort of review this, and mm-hmm. and we probably will meet at least one more time to try to,
sure,
maybe put a bow on it. And that's just what you said. One of the questions we have specifically for TAs is, well, first off, specifically, what class were you teaching last spring?
I was actually hired as a lecturer last spring. I was teaching a course on Sami culture.
Okay. So you mentioned, you sort of alluded to this, but mm-hmm. how did you budget your time during these, you know, basically the 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
Trying to balance being an activist but also being you know, in this case, a paid lecturer?
Well, it wasn't easy. You know, it was one of the most difficult, you know, couple months of my life trying to, you know, budget my time. Didn't make a lot of progress on my dissertation, that's for sure. But, you know, there's some things that are more important than that. During the initial, I think we missed three classes. I taught Tuesdays and Thursdays. We missed three classes. And, you know, it wasn't a strike. It was a teach out. So we made up the work. I had them, I believe, for two of the classes, I budgeted in my syllabus. I thought, well, at some point we'll watch a movie. You know, I've kind of figured we'll watch maybe two movies this semester on Sami culture, and then I can, you know, in case I'm falling behind with work and I just can't get my, it was the first time I taught the course. It was all this new content. So I thought, well, I'll just kind of tentatively have those sitting in the bag so I can just pull them out. We'll watch a movie this week, you know, rather than have me lecture. So I did one of those for two of the sessions. I had them watch a movie online, illegally downloaded, of course. And then the third one, I think I put up a PowerPoint on a Learn at UW site, and then I held some extra office hours or something to make up for the time. They had a paper due or something, so I figured it would be, you know, a good time to have some extra office hours anyway. So,
did you get any blowback from the students about?
Not a bit. I'm sure they didn't all agree with me, but you know, I think I leveled with them too. I mean, I said, well, for the first one, the first was the Tuesday when there was the Joint Finance Committee hearing. I wrote him an email, like, on that Monday, and I said, we're not going to have class tomorrow. I said that, you know, I'm very, you know, I told him about the Joint Finance hearing. I said, I think it's my, you know, sort of moral responsibility to be at this hearing to testify, because, you know, I think that this is a very important issue for public, for higher education. And it's, you know, it's more important that I'm there, you know, on this day to give my 3 minutes than be in class. I said we'd make it up, and, I think that's all I said. I mean, I never, you know, didn't try to say they should agree with me or not agree with me, but I just told them the truth that I thought I should be there. Then we called the teach-outs, too. And, you know, there was some weird bureaucratic language that came from the university, which you might sort of remember. We're trying to read between the lines, like the TAA, like core of activists at that time, and what are they really saying? Are they saying it's a, because they issued policy statements that were like, you shouldn't be holding your classes off campus, but, you know, of course you have flexibility to hold class whenever you'd like to have class and do your work schedule on you can schedule your classes anytime you'd like to schedule your classes. These are only recommended time slots or something. Basically, they're saying you have a lot of flexibility in how you teach. And, you know, if the university was really didn't want us there, they would have been issuing statements like, anyone who cancels class is going to be fired, you know, which is what, you know, that would be like the tack that union busting universities take. But, I mean, they wanted to, I mean, this university is incredibly union-friendly, but, I mean, they're not, they knew what was in store for the UW system and the budget anyway. So I think there were lots of people who were willing to let the university fight for itself and kind of look the other way. So that's the message we got anyway from reading between the lines. And then, you know, again, the second time I said, well, there's a teach-out. The TAA called a teach-out. I said, I don't remember the exact text in my email, but my message was, I basically said, I don't cross picket lines. I do with the, I stand in solidarity with, teaching assistants and, and undergrads who have called for, no classes to be taught on this day, and that's what I'm going to honor. And, I said, thanked him for indulging me, and, no one complained. And many students thanked me. Many students thanked me.
Since we've been talking about this for an hour or so now, I think this is my last thing for today,
okay.
And just because we've been talking about it, so hopefully it's on your mind, and this is one of these really open-ended questions, so it could go anywhere or nowhere. What was or was there for you a high point, and then conversely, was there a low point?
In the whole process?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of my favorite things, it was probably that first Thursday in the first week, when this sort of thing, this was taking a life of its own, and there was this realization that, the vibe was so much that you can turn up, 30,000 people or 50,000 people or whatever we were on those days, and it wasn't good enough to even make it, a ripple in the political process. It was such a feeling that, of being, isolated from and disenfranchised from, what politics are in this country. And it was a hard thing to swallow. We could have turned out a million people, and they still didn't give a shit, because they were going to do whatever the hell they were going to do. And so there was a sort of awakening realization to this. But, at the same time, we started really taking control of the Capitol at that time. And there was this one moment in particular, periodically, because I was working in the hallway for a week, periodically I would go out and look at the crowds and just kind of think, wow, look at this. This is amazing. I mean, there were some real moments there, So I was out there, and then I heard a roar in the crowd. And I looked down, I was trying to figure, why are they roaring now? And I looked down, and somebody had smuggled in all these helium balloons. And this is the first day I think anyone brought any helium balloons in, because they're not allowed. And so they brought in a bunch of helium balloons, and they had tied onto it a sign with the solidarity fist. And they let them go, and this beautiful sign was floating up to the top of the Capitol dome. It was just one of those moments that bring you chills. I mean, it was sort of we took the building, It was like a hoisting of a flag. It was a sign of victory, of sorts anyway. Because, you feel like the whole, the state house being a house of the people is just a sham, And so we hoisted our own flag, and it felt really good. So that was one of my high points, anyway. There are several instances like that. Another would be coming out of when the occupation ended, because there was a standoff from that Sunday when they did the lockdown until maybe Wednesday or Thursday, when people just kind of gradually trickled out because they wanted to shower and eat. And so we coordinated an exit, because we didn't want the numbers just to get smaller and smaller and smaller. So the last 30 people were in there, and so a couple hundred people showed up to welcome them when they came out and make it feel like a victory. It was probably March 3rd-ish, the last day of the occupation, 3rd, 4th. And everyone, they marched out one by one as heroes. I was on the outside, of course. I wasn't inside. They marched out as heroes. They negotiated this exit for a long time. And, you know, and they were playing music and chanting and singing and dancing, you know, because there are lots of the drum circles. You have the core that still gets in trouble regularly down there. And then everyone went over to Brokaw afterwards, and they had their first hot meal for, you know, that wasn't pizza for ages. So everyone went there, and there was an Irish band playing. And then some of my friends from TA, like Rob Henn and Mike Quito, he's a former co-president going back a decade or more. And they went down to the band and asked the band to start playing Union songs. So then the band started playing Union songs, and they were singing, and, you know, people were dancing and singing along. It was just one of these great organic moments, you know, like, where everything just sort of came together. It just felt really good. As far as low points go, you know, I think dejection is just part of the daily process, you know. You know, you feel good for a while, and then you think, oh, God, we can't win. And, you know, something you struggle with, you know, maybe daily, you know, for those 6 weeks. I struggle with it, you know. I struggled with it when, you know, Kloppenburg lost. I struggled with it when the recalls only picked up 2 seats. You know, you keep looking for silver linings and things, but, you know, ultimately, you know, there's a lot of disappointment that goes along, you know, with trying to launch a historic sort of fight, you know. So, I mean, like, literally, you can go, like, you know, for a while, everyone just has to check out for a while and remember that your life is tied to other things than, like, you know, winning this sort of political fight. Otherwise, you go a little bit nuts, I think. So.
All right, I think that, I hate to end on a low point.
But, that's all right.
I think it's probably a good stopping point for today. Thank you very much, Tim. I appreciate it. Okay, this is the third interview with Tim Frandy. We're here inside Memorial Library on the campus of UW-Madison. This interview is being done for what we call our Capitol Protest 2011 Oral History Project. Today is October 21st, 2011, and my name is Troy Reeves. I head the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So Tim, as I said, when I had the recorder turned off, we just have a few more questions and then want to leave it open to you if you have things you want to say or maybe even reiterate from previous interviews.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those questions I think we alluded to and you mentioned, but I think I want to ask it directly, and that's how did Facebook and other social media influence the protests?
Well, the two thoughts come to mind right away. And the first was, and I think we had actually talked about this last time, was the use of, like, Twitter and Facebook when we were trying to barricade doors, mm-hmm. which is a very short period of time, but it was a really effective way to communicate, because everyone had cell phones and you were living with your, you know, with your smartphones in the Capitol and, you know, using them to get out messaging and do that sort of work. So, you know, if you went to the Defend Wisconsin Twitter feed or the TAA Twitter feed, there would be, you know, lots of posts like, go to, you know, room 320 Northwest now and block the door. We need bodies. So that was important, you know, for a few days anyway, when we were able to do that successfully. But then they learned how to contain us better, so that, you know, that sort of fell by the wayside. Or, you know, on March 9th, I think it was, when people were, ended up storming the Capitol, because it was locked down, like, maybe on the 3rd,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, of course, that went out on all wires when they realized that the Senate was executing a budgetary or a logistical maneuver so they could pass the stripped-down version of the bill. You know, I got word via just email, but, you know, that was on Twitter, that was on Facebook, get to the Capitol now. And then there were more traditional ways. I remember walking up, as hurrying to the Capitol, and somebody was standing in on State Street near the Capitol Square, just yelling to everyone who walked by, "They're passing the bill now! Get to the Capitol! Go inside! They're passing the bill!" Just like, you know, like a town crier. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the cars started circling and just honking. This is what democracy looks like, over and over and over. And they circled the Capitol Square all night long, I think. But, you know, it alerted people, you know, check the news, something's happening. That was a really bizarre night. I think the thing that's maybe, you know, more important, though, is in the overall scheme of things was the use of Facebook in particular to communicate, to control messaging, and you know, spread the word. What happened the first days of the protests was that, you know, the first day we were picked up by the, you know, the Daily Cardinal and Badger Herald, and, you know, we even made the Isthmus on Valentine's Day, and we were all excited about that. And, but then as this thing went national, you know, as the Journal Sentinel picked us up, Journal Sentinel, very conservative paper, Wisconsin State Journal, very conservative leaning, and, you know, they endorsed Walker. You know, they really bought into his, you know, his rhetoric and, I would say, lies about, you know, the condition of Wisconsin state budget and the deficit, which wasn't nearly as bad as he said it was. But he, so, you know, in the state media and in the national media, they began running all these stories that would say, well, lots of people, you know, we turn out 30,000 people. They say thousands of protesters or hundreds of protesters came to Wisconsin State Capitol because their pay is being, their benefits are being cut. And then they put a quote by Scott Walker saying, oh, the state is broke, everyone has to sacrifice. But that's not the story, you know. And we all knew that intuitively. You know, we didn't know what the story was, but that was clear, it clearly felt wrong, you know. And so, you know, in the first couple of days, we're figuring out, well, what is the story? I mean, it wasn't about the bottom line. It was about, you know, it was about workers' rights. You know, if it were about the, you know, the 8% cut, you know, which is, you know, that's a hard cut, you know, especially for, you know, the incomes lots of state workers make. But if it were about the cut, you wouldn't have had all the people showing up. You know, people are mobilized about, you know, issues of rights, and they don't mobilize about, you know, benefits packages. You know, you could get a couple hundred people, you know, irate and yelling and stuff, but it certainly wouldn't have carried the momentum it had. So anyway, back to the Facebook. So, you know, we were barraged by the national media, you know, running these stories, you know, that said, oh, you know, unions are angry, you know, it's, you know, the overtones, all that, oh, the unions have got to bust on a bunch of people to, you know, make noise because they want to get their, you know, fat dues money, you know, which is, you know, just a big crock of shit as far as I'm concerned, you know. The union bosses don't really make that much, you know. And so anyway, you know, we'd have, you know, days literally I probably spent on Facebook, and I'd never really used it much before even. But just posting stories and, you know, commenting, you know, it's not about this, it's about this. Or, you know, look at this detail, they have this wrong, they have the facts wrong. Then we went and we would search for good data. I remember asking my friend William Banks, who he was, you know, Walker said, oh, we're in such terrible shape, the state, the budget, we can't afford anything, we're broke. And so, I asked him to... if you could go through some numbers and look at the states, you know, individual state by individual state, and see where do we lie. And so then we found, I forget what it was, I think we're like, we're right in the middle of the pack. You know, it's like, we're the 20th best state for the economic situation, 20th or 22nd or something, I think. You know, and so when we started, like, showing this data, and we'd, you know, put it out, you know, to on Facebook, and we'd email journalists and say, look at these numbers, look at these numbers, here are the numbers, we're not broke, we're not in, you know, financial crisis, look at all these other states that are, you know, we're, you know, we're not great, but, you know, we're doing okay, we don't need to bust unions for this. And so, like, I mean, my own opinion, though, is, like, the whole media is so terrible, you know, so corporatized that, you know, it's ineffective. And, you know, they gave the same coverage, I believe, one of those weeks to, you know, 30 Tea Partiers in Washington, D.C., as they gave to, you know, the tens of thousands of people rallying in Madison, you know, and that's just not right. It's just bizarre, you know. So I think, you know, in part of it, you know, at the time anyway, I remember having this distinct thought about the media. I was so fed up with the Journal Sentinel and the Wisconsin State Journal. I vowed never to buy their papers again, you know, because it was so infuriating because they were just spreading what I thought were lies about us. And but I mean, you know, the media has been, new print media has been in decline for so many years. I remember thinking, you know what, maybe it's a good thing. We can do this, you know, on the internet. We can do this through Facebook. We're more effective. We've got better information. We don't have the corporate, you know, backing that, you know, gets to control what's said and what's not. You know, I was celebrating the death of newspapers for the first time in my life during the protests because they weren't spreading good information, and the journalism was just abysmal. So anyway, I think that's kind of
okay.
I don't know if that makes much sense, or it's hard to frame it. It's kind of a big issue.
So were you posting these things on a specific Facebook page or a specific Facebook event? How did...
Oh, well, I just had my personal one that I was using, you know, and getting information out to other people, because I thought that, you know, I understood the issues fairly well, having been involved for a while. But, like, my friend Hillary, you talked to Hillary.
Mm-hmm.
You probably talked to her about the Solidarity Vigil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember when she was... asked me if I thought that would be a good idea. I said, yeah, definitely, definitely. And that really exploded.
And in terms of, were you checking, obviously, I mean, Hillary's page, I think it started as an event and then turned into a page.
Right.
But were you checking, you were posting on your page, but were you checking other people's pages and posts, either as they, well, I guess they would have to have appeared on yours. Were you doing that as well, or were you mainly just, you were getting a story and you were pushing it out on your page?
Well, I did everything I could think of, you know. I was pushing stories out from my page, and usually Hillary would catch them and put them on her page. You know, the event page, which had a I don't know, I have a few hundred friends or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but, like, you know, she got thousands, I'm sure, and all over the country. So I know, like, I'm sure lots of my stuff went out that way. You know, various times I remember doing all sorts of things. I remember writing Chris Rickert from the Wisconsin State Journal and complaining bitterly about some of his claims that he made, and tried to tell him he was not understanding the issues very well. I as much as I despise him, I even did, like, tried to do messaging controlling on blogs at one point, you know, because, you know, the little, like, anonymous user feedback underneath the journal articles, boy, those are just, you know, hateful and vitriolic. But once or twice I went in there and tried to do some damage control when they were, you know, in the state media, when they were getting overrun by, you know, really kind of extreme conservative voices. So.
And were you doing anything in terms of social media specifically under the TAA bailiwick? I mean, you said they had a Twitter feed.
Let me think. No, I don't. I wasn't doing much of that. The Alex Hanna, you know, the co-president, he's really good with media stuff, and so he had most of that under control. I did a lot of their messaging work, I think. Not all of it. I wrote a lot of, a handful of general membership emails to the membership because I knew how to message because I did it before. And then they signed their names to them and they went out. Then I think it's just, I mean, I think lots of the battle the first week, because we knew, like, well, in the earliest phases, we thought, well, we can get these three vulnerable Republicans to budge on this issue, like Luther Olson, Dale Schultz, and Dan Kopanky. And so we're doing tons of phone banking to people in their districts. But the other part of the battle was being able to frame the issues in ones that intuitively made sense. You know, winning that rhetorical battle on a national stage. I think, for me anyway, I recognized by the third or fourth day that that's what we had to do. That the only way we can put pressure on, you know, on the legislators and on Walker would be to bring this to a national level and try to, you know, win the rhetorical battle. You know, that it's... That he's, you know, lying about things, that he's just union busting. Because, I mean, he was effective in the earliest days saying, oh, it's about the, you know, budget line. Which, you know, of course, he took that back later on. He said, oh, yeah, it really wasn't about the money. We really just kind of wanted to bust the unions. I forget if it was him or one of the Fitzgeralds that said that. But that's, you know, winning the messaging war is the key thing. If you can't do that, then you're in a world of hurt because you're not going to get the public on your side. Then when we started getting feedback, when they started doing polls, in-state and national polls, and like by a 2-to-1 margin, people were opposing Walker's. It was like 65-35, I think, 62-38. People were opposing Walker's plan. Then we knew we were on the right track. I don't remember when that came out, in the first week. Mm-hmm. They did polling, and same on the. It was basically the same on the national level. I think that people were antagonistic to this, so then we knew that we were onto something big. You know,
I want to play off off that a little bit because you talked about winning the battle on the national stage.
Mm-hmm.
This is purely. I don't know if it's exactly my. It's an opinion that I have. I don't know how many people share it, but it mm-hmm. seems to me that. People on prominent politicians on the left or prominent Democratic politicians mm-hmm. Stayed away from Madison or stayed away from this issue. I mean,
federal, like Obama,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, sort of the two national names that come to my mind of people sort of with national prominence who came here were Jesse Jackson
mm-hmm.
and Michael Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of which are elected officials,
right?
So sort of a long introduction to a question about mm-hmm. How do you feel then about whether or not you got support from the larger elected officials? And if you want to talk about, you know, if you want to talk about sort of building out from local to mm-hmm. state to national.
Well, I would say... I mean, the state Democratic senators, the ones who left, you know, that was, I have nothing but admiration for that. That was really, you know, bold and courageous action on their part, and I think they're wonderful. I have enormous amounts of respect for all of them. Some more than others, you know, but, and I was, just so proud to have people like Jim Hopperin, he's a Democratic senator. He's from my home district up in northern Wisconsin, and, you know, he's always had a rough go because it's, you know, a little bit right-leaning up there, and, but, you know, he hung tough and did the right thing and, you know, won a recall election and, you know, I just have all the respect in the world for him. But I got to tell you, on the national stage, I mean, it was incredibly disappointing. I mean, I vote Democrat, but, they avoided Herb Kohl. He was silent. I mean, in my mind, that's just cowardice. You know, the biggest issue in his state, and I know it's a state issue and he doesn't have to get involved, but I mean, he wasn't even up for re-election, you know, because if it was already being revealed at that time that this was his last term, and he just stays out of it, you know. Feingold, of course, was much better. He's good on all sorts of progressive issues. I was enormously disappointed with Barack Obama. He made campaign promises to, you know, in the event of labor unrest, to put on a pair of comfortable shoes and walk the picket line. I actually saw several signs mocking that sort of statement. They had pairs of sneakers hanging from picket signs and said, "Obama, here's your shoes, now come march with us." You know, he made a few comments, like two comments, I think, in the national media. But they were really wishy-washy. Honestly, strategically, maybe it was a wise thing, because he was vastly unpopular at that point, because it's before this campaign that's just been started, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, and if he did get involved, maybe strategically that makes it look like it's being pushed by Obama, which starts to backfiring on a national stage. So, you know, strategically, maybe this is a good decision for him to stay away and make it seem, at least seem, worker-centered. But, you know, personally, I think it's, you know, reprehensible that, you know, he'll go and support labor unions in other countries and not stand up for, you know, workers' rights here at home. I mean, in my mind, it's pandering to, you know, corporate interests and, you know, I'd really like a real labor party in this country, and we just don't have. We've got some good politicians, but they don't gel around these issues. Even the state recalls, they didn't talk about this. So, you know, it's disappointing.
I would like to a couple more things, but since you mentioned it a couple of times now, I want to talk about or ask your thoughts about the August recalls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically how you thought they were going to go, how they actually went, and what you think any sort of either initial or maybe long-term benefit or lack of benefit from them. So basically just your opinion about the recall movement and then the recalls themselves.
Well, I was all in favor of the recalls. Not everyone I knew was. I mean, lots of the TAA folks are further left than me, and they think the whole system's broken, and it doesn't matter if you put in Democrats, but I still thought they were a good use of time and energy, and I remember, actually, maybe I don't mean to be too proud about this point. I think lots of people came up with this at the same time, but I was the first one in the people I was running with anyway, who's mentioned recalling the senators. Not like I came up with the idea, but I was talking to Paul Sickle. This was probably day three or something of the protest, and the recall walker signs were just coming up. And Paul Sickle, who's a staff organizer at MGAA, the Milwaukee Grad Assistance Association, I leaned over to him and said, "So I was thinking, and maybe this idea is stupid, and maybe I just don't understand it, but, like, can't we recall the state senators? And he said, yeah, I was sort of thinking, you know, maybe that could be an option. That's a really good idea. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But as far as the recalls went, I mean, I wasn't terribly involved with the recall process, but I think they went okay. You know, of course, it would have been nice to get Luther Olson out, because he was close. But I think it was the right thing to do. I mean, these were exceptional. I have many thoughts, I guess, because, like, personally, yeah, I think they're, you know, they should be recalled because I really strongly disagree with their politics. Two, I think the means and methods that they used to pass the bill were highly inappropriate. I mean, the way I see Wisconsin tradition is that politically you build consensus over time and don't make, you know, power moves. And through the process of, you know, public debate and discourse and building consensus for ideas, especially for radical ideas, you know, radical changes like this, you know, I could have accepted if, you know, Walker talked about this on the campaign trail, if he talked about it for a year, put it to a vote, and then we lost. You know, that would have been a hard, bitter, bitter defeat. But I could have accepted the fact that, you know, Wisconsin people don't want unions. You know, crushing if that would have happened. But that would, if that process of, you know, would have been more okay with me. But, you know, trying to pass legislation in 4 days, radical extremist legislation, was just, you know, everyone involved with that should be, you know, told strongly that they cannot do that in Wisconsin. We used to have a tradition of clean politics, you know, and we need to restore that. So, overall, you know, of course they didn't get the three they hoped for, but they got two. And when lots of people pointed to the data shift that happened, like, there's like a 5% shift in each of these elections that, you know, all the Democratic candidates went up 5 points from the election the previous year, and all the Republicans went down about 5 points. And so that was in both the Republican and Democratic recalls. So the way I interpret that is that, you know, 5% of the voting population is across the state has kind of moved to the left on this issue. So that could, you know, have an impact, you know, for the next bout of recalls this next year.
What did you learn from the protests?
What did I learn? I don't know if I learned anything. I think well, there's something about the way it happened that you know, I didn't think such a thing was possible, because I've never really seen it in my lifetime, you know, on a sort of, I mean, I know that every 100 years or whatever, every 40, 50 years, you know, there are these, you know, social justice movements that kind of emerge and come and go. I was born in 78, you know, I never saw the Vietnam protests. And so, you know, I guess, you know, I learned it, optimistically, I learned it's possible to do. But well, that's a hard and vague question.
Mm-hmm.
I learned Scott Walker's a douchebag, and I really don't like him.
Okay.
You know, well, Well, in all seriousness, though, I mean, disagreements aside, because I, you know, I can disagree with the politics and try to sit down and have a rational discussion with somebody who's conservative, and that's really important to me. You know what? You know that. I mean, like, it's really important to be able to disagree and compromise, and you know, come up with, you know, solutions that are to problems on a state political level, and you know, families and communities, you know, every sort of level. Being able to handle disagreement is, I mean, that's what our job is at the university, to negotiate, facilitate discourse, and, you know, keep people talking. And so the tactics that he used, you know, not only just, you know, trying to slip the bill through in the dead of night without any resistance, you know, breaking their own rules to do it, you know, and just, you know, muscling power, being completely unresponsive to the, you know, largest protests that Madison's ever seen in numbers. And, you know, I mean, that's abhorrent to me. And beyond that, when these details from the prank calls come out, for example, that he planned to, you know, plant troublemakers in the crowd to discredit the movement, that he had conversations with other conservative politicians who openly encouraged him to stage a fake assault on himself, you know, plant someone to beat him up and have this plant act like a, you know, left-wing guy to discredit the movement. That's sick. The Deputy Attorney General of Indiana said that he should shoot us. He said, use live ammunition. I encourage the use of deadly force. That's really messed up. I mean, it's just, I can't wrap my head around that, you know. You know, when you disagree with someone, you talk it out, you don't shoot them. And, like, but that's, you know, that's what the modern, you know, Tea Party, right-wing, conservative bloc of the Republican Party is about. And, you know, that's just, I mean, it's not okay with me. And it shouldn't be okay with anyone, as far as I'm concerned.
I want to ask you to perhaps look into your crystal ball. Mm. Since we're interviewing you, you currently are a staff person and a still graduate student, but yeah, also a staff person here. What are, at this point, what are your future plans? First off, what are your future plans academically?
You know, with the job market so bad, you know, it's, I'm just looking for a job. You know, I'd love to teach someplace. I could get a, you know, it'd be nice to get a professorship someplace. I'd love to work at a, like, in-state Wisconsin school. But to be honest, the reality of the jobs in the humanities have been down 35% for two consecutive years. And now the UW is absorbing, you know, I think almost $300 million in budget cuts, and the net public dollars is the same as it was in, like, 1980 that we're getting. That's not adjusted for inflation, you know. I don't know if I get a job, you know, in the near future. So I'm preparing for the worst. But I would like to stay in the area and get a nice lower middle class job and hopefully have a career that's, you know, keeps me happy enough and pays the bills and can live in a place I want to live.
And what about politically? I mean, obviously, you know, I'm not asking if you're going to run for office, but sort of, do you have plans to continue to, I guess I would say, fight this fight?
Yeah. Well, I mean, honestly, I think that there's different ways you can, you know, fight the fight, and it takes a lot of people to do it, in different roles. One of my, you know, I might be what you call an activist teacher, you know, and I think education, you know, is one of these ways that we can, you know, effect change. And, you know, I think bringing these issues to students and being able to frame the issues in, you know, responsible, respectful ways is a really important part of, you know, the political activism process. In particular in K through 12, which isn't my field, but, you know, right now, but I teach people who will be teachers, you know, by teaching at a university. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to get the issues, you know, framed in, you know, the right ways so that they're understood. Because, I mean, you've got the Texas Board of Education writing school books for all the kids, and they're, you know, talking about how great Joe McCarthy is, you know, like, and then saying, well, you can't talk about politics if you disagree with us. So that's a huge fight in and of itself. But of course, living in Madison now, you're just more tuned and you have more opportunities to be effective in the political process and on the state level. But I suppose, I don't know where I'm going to be in a couple of years. I could be anywhere. But yeah, I'm always going to be involved with unions and workers' rights and working class issues and these sorts of things. Just because they're important to me. I think, you know, economic injustice is one of the... For years, I've thought, economic injustice, the division of wealth, have been, you know, probably the most significant problem our country is facing. And we've only made things worse in my lifetime, not better at all.
That actually reminds me of one more thing I want to say, because it's a... But this is all current events, obviously. I mean, you could argue this is all current events, but sort of current events is the Occupy movement.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, in your mind, did the Occupy movement, did what happened here in Madison in February and March have anything to do with these recent Occupy movements, whether it's Occupy Wall Street or some of the larger cities, or even some of the larger cities, not only in the U.S., but in the world. So basically, what are your thoughts on that, particularly as it's very new right now, and who knows what's going to happen to it?
Well, I think it has everything to do with it. I mean, not to say that the Occupy grew out of Madison, because I don't... that seems a little self-centered, but I think there's a definite link in the fact that we've hit a sort of tipping point on the national level, that people are, I think a lot of people who have been indulgent of, you know, trickle-down capitalism are just, you know, more and more realizing that this economic policy does not work. We've tried it for 30 years. We're not doing better. We're doing a lot worse. And that everyone feels disempowered to, you know, affect these problems, you know, through the traditional political process. You know, when legislation cannot effectively, you know, control bankers, hedge fund managers, corporate executives, who just are able to, you know, out gimmick and out fox any legislation, you know, it gets to the point of absurdity. So I think on a national level, things have hit a tipping point, and we've got a whole generation of people who were told, if you know, if you do the right things, if you get yourself educated, if you work hard, you'll be able to get a, you know, have you know, a decent middle class life if you, you know, work hard and do all the right things. But, you know, that's not coming to fruition for a lot of people. And so I think on a national level, there's quite a bit of, you know, outrage about these broken promises that society, you know, the country led people on to believe. And I think it is the inability to affect the political process that's causing the Occupy movements to grow as well.
Tim, are there... Now that we've talked, well, three three times, but we've talked about 35 minutes this time. And I realize both of our memories are sort of fuzzy on what we talked about the first two times, but is there anything that you feel it important to get on the record as we wrap up here today?
Well, I don't know. I think that the one thing that keeps coming to my mind is one of my friends, framed the issue to me once. New York had just passed the gay marriage law just a couple months ago. And, I was like, oh, that's good, happy about that. And lots of my friends were going to New York to get married, and it's like, oh, cool, that's great. And he said to me, I don't mean to be a downer, but I'm just so sick of gay marriage. I said, what? And I said, because I couldn't even imagine that. And he said, no, it's all fine and good. But he said, I'm so tired of people who pat themselves on the back because they're, socially progressive, because they think that their gay friends should be married, and they congratulate themselves on how, leftist and awesome they are. And he said, that's like the easiest issue to get behind if you're a progressive. You don't have to do anything. You can just say, I support gay marriage. And, it's just to be expected. And now it's the majority of the population in the U.S. who supports gay marriage, I think. He said, but, people don't care about, economic progressive issues. People don't care about economic justice right now. It's easy to get behind the social issues, but nobody gets behind economic oppression and we're not doing anything for the working class. I've been saying this for years, and we have to do better. And I started thinking more about that, and it always seemed to me that, or it started to seem to me more and more like these economic issues need to get that sort of, fashionable discourse. They have to be chic, in the national media. I mean, the people who are working with them need to make them not the old, stale, crusty unions, but, make it so strategically, so on a national level, if somebody's like, I don't know about these, poor people, they probably deserve to get the low minimum wages that they get, that other people will look at them and say, really? Are you really that 19th century, that you think that? You think that our society is good to poor people? You are really messed up, and be able to, chastise them on that sort of level. And maybe it's a little bit cruel, but, it's worked with other, social movements. If somebody says something like, I just don't know about the black people, that people will call them on it and say, wow, that's not okay. This was all before the Occupy stuff started happening. And, maybe it's taking off. I really hope it is, that people are, willing to speak up more for economic injustice. So anyway, that's about the best thought I have, I guess.
Well, it's probably not a bad thought to end on. So we'll chat here for a second after this. So this concludes the third interview with Tim Frandy. Thanks, Tim, for your time. Mm-hmm.